Project, we are throwing it back to November 2018 with one of the most popular guests that we have ever had on the show. We've done two episodes with him. This is the first one. This is Mr. Patrick McEwen from Oxygen Advantage. He has another company as well related to dental alterations with breathing, and that's a whole separate thing, but we did kind of dabble in it a little bit. But this whole episode is really about performance and breathing and airways, and just such a, you know, I remember this podcast in particular making such an impact on the way I thought about breathing and performance and just how I go about everyday life. And that was the feeling that everyone got when they listened to this podcast. And that's why we knew when he was coming to Australia, we had to get him on for a second time. And then also what was interesting about this episode is when it aired a few weeks later, so many of my family, my close family, my relatives, they shared this episode around because we've had, you know, in the family, genetically, our snoring must be a big thing. And it made such a difference. The mouth tape made a huge difference. Fixed so many people overnight that have, you know, had surgeries, had like crazy machines. My dad had weird machines on his face before, you know, trying to fix his snoring issue and all kinds of different drugs. None of it worked. And this was the first thing ever that worked. And it only cost like $5, this piece of tape. So Pat illuminating some of the most interesting stuff we've ever had on the podcast.
Yeah, I think this podcast probably goes down in, I would say, the top 10. Over 5-6 years of impact on just our daily life and our training.
Yeah.
You know, most episodes will have a small impact. I'll try a few things. Some episodes you really change a lot and you change it for the long term.
Mm.
And I think this was one of them.
Yeah, absolutely. And having an impact and changing can be difficult, which is why we recruit nutrition coaches for good reason to help us break really bad habits. Right now, Raf and I are working with the Working Against Gravity team. So at workingagainstgravity.com, if you guys sign up to their coaching, then you basically get assigned someone through their app, which is amazing. And, you know, apps make things so much easier, so much better than Excel sheets and Word documents and emails back and forth. So we keep all our communication with our coach in there. We've got our check-ins in there, our weights, before and after photos, our macros. It ties in automatically with MyFitnessPal if you use that. It's just an amazing process and stuff. Some really good changes we've made. I've been able to consistently eat more protein, which has been difficult for me. And during the isolation, reduce my carbs, which has been good just to from the reduced activity. That's been really helpful. So if you guys are interested in starting nutrition coaching, you can go to workingagainstgravity.com. If you use the code MMP50, so MMP50, one word when you check out, you're going to get $50 off your first month. All right, guys, enjoy this first episode again with Patrick McEwen. This is Lachlan Rouston.
This is Raf Friedman, and you're listening to the fittest podcast in Australia,
The Mind Muscle Project. All right, Mind Muscle Project, welcome back to another episode. On the show today, we have Patrick McEwen, and he is the founder of Oxygen Advantage. And Oxygen Advantage, interesting. There's a TED Talk with nearly 500,000 views on it, and it's called Shut Your Mouth to Change Your Life, I believe. It is a really good TED Talk. It's a TED Talk which involves audience participation, which is cool, which is unique for TED Talks. But essentially, we brought Pat on today because Pat has got some really interesting stuff on breathing and oxygen work, and we have had some breathing people on in the past, but I must say their science was not very strong. This is a big change for us.
Yeah, today. Well, we did have a really good episode with Brian McKenzie on course, breathing, yeah. But we didn't really go into the mechanics at all of breathing.
Mm.
It was more just like really related to training and how you can use it there.
And also, I don't think it has been Brian's focus for his whole life, no. As long as it has been for you, Pat. And that's really where I wanted to start is like, you know, you mentioned what your wife always tells people that, you know, my husband works on people's breathing and it doesn't seem like he'd actually make a real career out of that, but you know, you were just mentioning that, or we're just looking through the seminars you got coming up. You're all over the world, from like Warsaw and Poland to New York to Sydney. And you're teaching people how to breathe better, how to improve their breathing, and you're explaining it along the way. But how did you get into it, and like, how did it all start for you?
It was purely accident. My background is economics, and I had very bad asthma for about 20 years. And with that, I had nasal obstruction, because whatever goes on in the lungs can also travel up to the nose and vice versa. And if your nose is stuffy, then your sleep is affected. So people with nasal congestion are twice as likely to have sleep problems. So they don't have concentration and they're lacking in focus. They don't have the same productivity. And this was going on for me for about 20 years. I was being to doctors. I was in and out of hospital, not so many times, but about 4 times. And then I read about an article about the importance of breathing through your nose, and there was an exercise in it to open up the nose, which I started to practice. And I was starting to get relief in my nose for in about 5 minutes or so.
Mm.
So I made the switch to nasal breathing. It took a little bit of work because I was feeling very suffocated. If you have your mouth open constantly and you're breathing through it for, say, 15, 20 years, your body adapts to that. So I was trying to reverse that habit. So initially I was feeling suffocated, but I kept going and I started waking up alert for the first time. My asthma symptoms went down about 50% within 1 week. It was really, really quick. And it was something that gave me instant feedback that I knew I was onto the right thing.
Mm. That's really interesting that it cleared up so quickly. The one thing obviously that I was thinking about when I was hearing this thing at first is like, I actually breathe through my nose a lot my whole life. And that one thing that you were taking it back is, and I've never heard this before, but you're saying how you breathe as a child actually dictates the shape of your face. And you know, a good looking person like myself has obviously been breathing through their nose their whole life. I was like, it obviously makes sense. Like, I've been breathing through my nose all life. But how is that? How did you come to that conclusion, or what was kind of going on there where you thought?
It's not my conclusion at all. Just basically, you know, this has been documented back since the early 1900s. The Dental Cosmos Journal in 1909 said if children are mouth breathing, it leads to crooked teeth, setback of the jaws, a narrow palate, a longer face. And pretty much it's based on the principle that when your mouth is closed, your tongue is resting in the roof of the mouth. And as your tongue rests in the roof of the mouth during childhood, it's the tongue that helps to drive the jaws forward.
Mm.
But also the tongue is U-shaped, so it will create a wider jaw, a wider maxilla. So there's plenty room for the teeth. Now, what's more importantly, though, say, here is our anatomical model of the nose.
Mm.
A good airway is the size of your thumb. Now, and you really need a good airway because people don't often consider, they consider that the nose is just a piece in the face. But really what we want to consider is the nasal cavity goes right back into the skull.
Mm.
Now, if, for instance, the jaws are set back, so here's the mandible or the maxilla, and if it's set back for any reason, the airway is going to be smaller.
Mm.
So if we have a child that's been mouth breathing for a long period of time, even more than 6 months, that can cause craniofacial changes leading to jaws that are not fully developed. The jaws are set back. The airway is smaller. And this child is not going to grow into an athlete because we need efficient breathing, but we also need good windpipe. And if you consider that a good airway is the size of a garden hose pipe, we don't have that much room for error.
Mm.
And the other thing is, when the airway is very small and the mouth is open, the tongue is more likely to fall back into the airway. So the tongue will rest in two places. Either it rests in the roof of the mouth, and that's where it should be. And when it's in the roof of the mouth, then you're taking it out of the airway. But if you have the mouth open, the tongue falls back, and then you're more likely to have what's a condition called obstructive sleep apnea. So the crucial period of time that when we're growing up with our mouths closed and tongue up and roof of the mouth, if we have the mouth open for a period of time, we develop forward head posture, it affects the mechanics, and the physical changes that happen to breathing, they will often carry through to the rest of our life.
Mm.
So if you had your wisdom teeth out, like they couldn't fit, you're more likely to be in that camp because your face is a bit narrower.
Yes, it's not ideal to have extractions. There's a brilliant orthodontist in Sydney, Dr. Derek Mahoney, and he's got a team of ENTs. He's just completed a PhD, and I think he looked at 9,000 children. And he's a world-leading orthodontist, and he's been looking specifically at this, the development of the airway. So dentists know it, but unfortunately, this information doesn't trickle down to the general public. Mm. The general public do not know it. So if I'm looking at an athlete, the one thing that I'll often look at is you just look at their face and look at their breathing and you will get an idea. Because really we want to get back to the basics here. We need a good airway and we need functional breathing patterns, and functional breathing influences functional movement. The two go together. You know, if you have the mouth open, you're very more likely to be using the upper chest muscles, the accessory muscles, the sternocleidomastoid, the scalene muscles, and we're not using the diaphragm effectively. But the diaphragm muscle is really, really important for motor control and for stabilization of the spine, for core strength, and also for functional movement. Mm. So it's really important that, you know, how many times does an athlete be told you need to train your breathing? And yet it's often our breathing that limits our, you know, physical ability. That intense feeling of breathlessness, if the athlete is gassing out too soon, and it's often put down to poor condition. But you could have an athlete who's training a lot, but if they have poor breathing patterns in their everyday breathing, no matter how hard they train, they'll plateau and they'll find it difficult to get that edge. So that's what I'm interested in breathing is, you know, how can we help people reach their full potential? Whether it's the child that's growing up with the mouth open, that's what we need to address. Whether it's the athlete or even just your normal everyday person, change their breathing patterns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, what was interesting is, man, we had a, I can't remember her name, but we had a sleep doctor on before. Allison?
Mm. I think Allison.
Dr. Allison, yeah. Someone. And she used to be an elite athlete, and she said that she now can maintain pretty similar times and scores to what she used to be able to do, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, with less training but more breath practice. She focuses on some of the Wim Hof stuff. I'm sure you're familiar with that. It's obviously the most mainstream stuff at the moment, but that focus on the breathing has allowed her to improve her just efficiency during workouts, and she can kind of like maintain even though she's not training as much. I do want to get to that and what's going on there at the blood level, but just before we get to that, I just want to come back to the child thing because I'm very interested in it. I don't have a kid, but I'm just curious. How does a child become a nose breather and a mouth breather? Obviously, they're not thinking about it. They're not like making a decision about it. Yes, so what have you noticed as to like which, how do you go from, because you start a nose breather, how do you then move to mouth breathing?
Yeah, it typically happens when the child is going through teething, usually about 7 or 8 months of age.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going through teething and they get the first upper respiratory infection that their nose now is getting stuffy. Now, the young infant will actually try and continue breathing through the nose, but they'll struggle. And eventually then what they'll do is they will switch to mouth breathing. Now, that can be the part of it. And it seems to be, though, if it continues over a few months that the habit starts becoming ingrained, but there's also a genetic issue to it as well. Children can be born with narrow jaws. My own daughter, she probably has my genetic profile, so she has narrow jaws, and she would be at a disadvantage because now there's not enough room for the tongue and the roof of the mouth. So the airways are already compromised due to genetics. However, this is really the key aspect of it here. If we have a child who has been mouth breathing and with narrow jaws, you can still fix it early on. And it doesn't matter whether it's the mouth breathing that has contributed to the narrow jaws or the narrow jaws which has contributed to the mouth breathing. Because if a child wears a functional appliance, and a functional appliance could be a light wire appliance that is inserted by an orthodontist, and basically the appliance is just to gently develop the jaws to the size that they need. Mm. The problem with, say, crooked teeth, it's not that the teeth are too big. It's not that, you know, oftentimes traditional orthodontists will sometimes say that, yeah, somebody has crooked teeth because they inherited dad's big teeth and mom's small jaw. So it's the problem is not that the teeth are too big. The problem is that the jaw is too small. And when the jaws are too small, there's not enough room for the teeth. But also when the jaws are too small, the airway can be compromised. And that's why, you know, I often say like dentists are debating this for almost 100 years, but there's no debate about this. Let's get any child who is breathing through their mouth and with a compromised airway and a very simple device that you can expand the palate, you can, you know, expand the maxilla and bring the jaws forward on the face, and that child will have that for the rest of their life. Mm. I think it's a great intervention, something to be addressed. Now, adenoids can be an issue when the child is 2 to 6 years of age. And adenoids basically is when the back of the nose gets obstructed. So it's lymphoid tissue here at the back, which becomes swollen, which blocks the back of the nose. But again, with that, enlarged adenoids are only a problem when the airway is small. So really, it's coming down to the airway. If you have got a really adequate airway, even if the adenoids are a little bit enlarged, it should be fine. The child can still maintain nasal breathing. And even if you Google it, you know, Google adenoid face, you'll see that there's a facial characteristic associated with mouth breathing. It's not attractive, but it's not functional either. These kids will suffer from sleep problems. It's linked with ADD. And of course, you know, adults as well. If adults have poor quality sleep, it's difficult to focus and concentrate. And that's one thing we need for quality of life.
Yeah, I remember when my when I was like really very young, obviously before I even can remember, my parents used to be worried about me because my breathing was so quiet. They thought I wasn't breathing. And it's interesting. I always thought that was a problem. I'm like, man, my breathing was so quiet. Like maybe I wasn't getting enough oxygen in. But after listening to some of your stuff, I've realized that the best thing you can do for your breathing is to breathe as softly as possible, to be as quiet as possible. Before we jump to that, I wanted to go back to the I wanted to go back to the what's happening at the oxygen level. So it's kind of all links in, obviously. But the rapid breathing you were saying is and the deep breaths is actually. Like getting more oxygen in doesn't necessarily mean you'll use more oxygen. Can you kind of explain what's going on at the blood muscle level, hemoglobin stuff?
Sure. So basically oxygen is relatively insoluble in the blood. So it needs a carrier, and that carrier is hemoglobin. And hemoglobin is a protein that's found within the red blood cell. So hemoglobin carries 98% of the oxygen in the blood. It's carried by hemoglobin. And 2% of oxygen is carried directly, dissolved directly in the blood. Now, you can imagine hemoglobin that's carrying oxygen, but what causes hemoglobin to release oxygen? It's carbon dioxide, it's increased heat, it's this phosphoglycerate. But my point here is that we can measure people's pulse oximetry very easy. You use a little infrared, there's a little pulse oximeter, as you see here.
Used one
before,
yeah.
It's got an infrared light here, but it's also got a red light, and it's able to pick up on how fully loaded is your hemoglobin with oxygen. We have people coming in with exhaustion, people coming in with high stress, with panic attacks, and I'm saying to, listen, your blood oxygen saturation is normal. The problem is not that you don't have enough oxygen in the blood. The problem is that the oxygen that's in the blood isn't getting from the blood to the cells. So the real crux of it here is that, and we have so much oxygen in our bloodstream, that oxygen levels need to drop by half before the brain will notice that there's a change and start breathing. The stimulus to breathe is not oxygen, it's actually carbon dioxide. And carbon dioxide is not just a waste gas. Carbon dioxide is catalyst for oxygen from the hemoglobin. But here it comes back to it. If we are breathing too hard, number one, it does not increase oxygen, blood oxygen uptake. So hard breathing won't increase your saturation of hemoglobin. You're already going to be 95 to 99%. Hard breathing, though, gets rid of carbon dioxide. And when you're losing CO2, the bond between hemoglobin and oxygen strengthens. So you were talking about the benefits of light breathing. Yes, light breathing is good because you have a normal concentration of carbon dioxide in the bloodstream. And with a normal concentration of CO2 in the blood, hemoglobin releases oxygen more readily. And really, that's what it's about. The crux about breathing is, how do we get oxygen delivery to the cells? How do we get oxygen delivery to the organs? And also, how do we influence our blood circulation? And we can do that through our breath.
Yeah, it is very interesting. So the practice of the light breathing and some of the breathing techniques that obviously you train people with, how long do you find it takes them to have the carryover to like performance? So if you're getting obviously people to practice these things at rest, which some of the techniques we can go into, like how long till it translates to their on-field performance?
It should be within about 2 to 4 weeks. You should see a difference. It's relatively quickly. The first thing we do is we've got two measurements. One is called a BOLT, body oxygen level test. And the BOLT score is you take a normal breath in through your nose, a normal breath out through your nose, you pinch your nose with your fingers, and you time it in seconds. How long does it take until you feel the first definite desire to braid. If your bowl score is less than 25 seconds, it's indicator of dysfunctional breathing patterns or poor breathing patterns. And what this means is that the individual who's doing physical exercise will experience disproportionate breathlessness.
Mm.
So your bowl score, the breath hold time during rest, gives you a good feedback of your degree of breathlessness, both the onset of breathlessness, how soon you become breathless during physical exercise, and also the endurance of breathlessness. How breathless are you throughout the physical exercise? So basically, by using a simple breath hold time during rest, we can get an idea of athletes who are gassing out too soon. I'll give you an example. A couple of weeks ago, I was working with a bronze medalist Olympian, and he's from the UK, and his bowl score was 12 seconds. Now, he was complaining. He went to his doctor, and he was complaining with exercise-induced bronchoconstriction, not necessarily asthma. But here's an individual who is breathing so hard during his training that it's causing the airways to constrict, and he's feeling the tightness. And of course, once your airways constrict, that's going to limit you. So his bowl score at 12 seconds. And also when I look at his breathing pattern, it's upper chest breathing. There's no natural pauses between breaths. The amplitude is fairly large. So here's a guy who's breathing excessively during rest, and that's going to translate into excessive breathing during physical exercise. Now, the second score test that we use is called the maximum breathlessness test. And this involves you take a normal breath in through your nose, a normal breath out through your nose, you pinch your nose and you start walking. And you count how many paces you can walk until the maximum. So what you want to do is you're measuring what's the absolute upper tolerance of breathlessness that this individual can handle. Now, when I'm working with somebody, I want to try and get them to achieve 80 paces. But if they're less than 60, it tells me that they're gassing out too soon. So if we have people who are working a lot anaerobically, say, for instance, if you have MMA or et cetera, you know, we want to get them to be able to have a very high maximum breathlessness test because these guys are going to be working using their anaerobic capacity, and we want to push it out there. And it's interesting in terms of there's two parts to what I do. One is functional breathing training, but the other one is called hypoxic hypercapnic training. And in a recent study, well, it's a few months now, they used it with elite rugby union players. So these are professional players from Australia. And they had them practice this for 4 weeks. And basically what it involved was it's repeated sprintability. Breathe in through your nose, breathe out through your nose, pinch your nose, and sprint for 40 meters with your breath held. Then release, wait 30 seconds and do it again. And do 7 repetitions in one sesh, 2 sets per week. And over 4 weeks, their repeated sprintability increased from 9 to 14 before exhaustion.
Mm.
And that's a huge parameter. But we have to bear in mind, these are professional athletes. Mm. And usually with professional athletes, the margins of improvement, you know, you're not talking about major percent. But these guys, like 9 to 14 is a one-third gain. Mm. 33% gain in repeated sprintability. And repeated sprintability is really important for team sports. It's your ability to sprint, but you don't have much of a recovery before you sprint again. And that's what it improved. But I can send you on the paper at the end of our talk here.
Mm, that would be good. I think you need to, I'm sure you know where Conor McGregor lives. I think you need to track him down and fix his breathing because he keeps gassing out in the second round. So I'm sure he'll reach out to you.
I've seen his breathing. I don't know Conor. I've seen his breathing during press conferences. And you know, you look at anybody during a press conference when they're not doing physical exercise. Yeah, it's okay at the end of sports, people will be a little bit breathless. Of course they are. They're recovering.
Mm.
Look at his breathing during press. Is he breathing from the chest? Is there large amplitudes of breathing? No natural pauses. And that's poor breathing, you know, and that's going to translate into problems.
Mm.
I feel like he's the last person that would accept tape over his mouth.
I don't know, man. I feel like he'd do anything at this point after what happened in the last fight.
Maybe,
but
maybe the tape should be on
all the time, to sleep
and also during the day, every now and again, huh?
Yeah. It's funny because MMA fighters, they're definitely. It's interesting how they breathe because they're one of the few sports that put a lot of. They do have a lot of stuff for breathing. I think it's kind of stemmed a lot from the jiu-jitsu world, but also they time a lot of their techniques with breathing. There's like, you know, exhaling when you punch and that sort of thing. So breathing is kind of a natural part of the sport already. But what's interesting is like they try and fight a lot of the fight without opening their mouth, because when they fight each other, I know this so well, obviously, because I'm a fan, but also my brother's a professional MMA athlete, and he's saying that, you know, when you see the jaw drop open during the fight, you know that the opponent is way more gassed. And so then now they're a lot more vulnerable to different techniques. So part of it, you know, when you train is keeping your mouth closed as long as possible, because you're trying to, whether you're gassed or not, you're trying to show that you're not gassed to your opponent, so that they don't try and, you know, take advantage of you.
Isn't it also better if you get punched with your mouth closed as opposed to open?
Yes. Yeah.
So your jaw doesn't move around?
I think that's one of the big parts. If you get a strike with your mouth closed, your jaws are more stable.
Yeah.
Versus you could probably more likely to break your jaw when the mouth is open.
Definitely.
But you can change. If we were measuring, say, using pulse oximetry with sprinters, and they were 400-meter sprinters, and we would have them do the 400-meter sprint with their mouth open, and their pulse oximetry drops to about 93%. And then we would get them to do the same sprint with their mouth closed. Of course, it adds an extra load. It drops down to 91%. But then what I did was, in the 400-meter sprint, I stood at 40 meters from the end. So basically, I had them sprint with their mouth closed for 360 meters. And then when they seen me for the last 40 meters, they had to breathe in, breathe out, and hold their nose, and run the last 40 meters without air. Because really what I wanted to do was, I wanted to add a challenge onto them when these guys are most fatigued. And you're most fatigued at the last 10% of the race or the game. So I think it would be a great way with MMA fighters, train with mouth taped. Because here you're adding an extra load on, and this is going to cause adaptations, but also do some breath holding. And I often wondered, you know, in terms of the chokehold, is it that the individual has to, if you have an athlete who's able to tolerate that degree of suffocation, that they may not panic, that they may not tap out so quickly. Mm. Now, I'm not sure, is it the collapse of the carotid arteries which is causing the individual to tap out, or is it the immense feeling of suffocation? So what I would have them do is actually do breath holding to train your body to be able to cope with holding your breath for a longer period of time. So when you are in that situation, number one is psychologically you're able to bear it, but also chemically. So when we talk about breathing, we need to be looking at the biomechanics of breathing, the biochemistry of breathing, but also the psychophysiological aspects of breathing. And that's taken into account the mind. Mm. So yeah, we're playing with the breath. And I spoke about, like, during a sprint, if you went an all-out 400-meter sprint with your mouth closed, your SpO2, which is the saturation of your peripheral blood vessels with oxygen, will drop down to about 91%. Whereas we drop our guys way below. And what I want to do is, I want to put them into a hypoxic situation to disturb the blood acid base balance. So basically, we flood the muscle with hydrogen ion. And the hydrogen ion is changing the acidity inside in the muscle. Now, what that does is it forces then the body to make adaptations, including improving the buffering capacity inside in the muscle. So if you can improve the buffering capacity either inside in the muscle or inside in the blood, increased buffering can reversibly bind with hydrogen ion so that the athlete isn't going as acidic. It doesn't go into acidity as quick. And these are all simple changes you can make with simple exercises.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. How do you feel about the stuff that's out there, like the, I forget what the mask is called.
McBain mask.
Yeah.
Training mask.
The training mask, that's right. Yeah, how do you feel about those implements?
I think it's very interesting. I think it's a very good device. I think when the people put it out there at first, they were making claims that they weren't able to. I bought the masks back 6-7 years ago.
Mm.
And we were training with them with pulse oximetry. And I kept on wondering, what's going on here? Because this is supposed to be an elevation training mask, but yet my blood oxygen saturation wasn't lower. So I tried it with different athletes, and I said, there's something going on, because here you can test anything if it claims that it's going to create a hypoxic effect.
It's like the lie detector.
You can, get, you can get a pulse oximeter. This one here costs about $300, but you can pick them up for about $30. Put it on your finger, do your physical exercise wearing the device, and it will tell you straight off if it's hypoxic or not.
Mm.
So it's not a hypoxic training device, but it does pool carbon dioxide. And it will help to reduce what's called the ventilatory response to CO2. Basically, it teaches the body to be able to handle carbon dioxide or handle a larger quantity or concentration of CO2. Now, the other thing is it will put an extra load onto the breathing muscles. However, you could train with your mouth closed, because there's an entirely different breath by keeping your mouth closed during training. Number one, it's going to be deeper. It's a slower breath. It's a deeper breath. It's a bigger breath, but it's a reduced respiratory rate, so it will be a slower breath. If you train with your mouth closed, you'll also put a load onto the breathing muscle. And another thing is that nasal breathing, because during the day, it imposes a resistance to your breathing that's 2 to 3 times that of the mouth, basically because the nostrils are smaller.
Mm.
So in order to get air through that narrowed space, it adds an extra load. That alone will strengthen the diaphragm muscle. I do think it's worth diaphragm training and strengthening the muscle. It's estimated that up to 50% of athletes are prone to diaphragmatic fatigue. Now, the breathing muscles, we have to think of the breath as king, and it trumps everything. And if your diaphragm muscle gets tired, what happens is that blood is stolen from the legs to be diaphragm, and then blood is stolen from the leg, your legs are going to go jelly. So this is maybe back to Conor McGregor again. You remember with the Mayweather fight, I think it was on the 8th or 9th round, the referee, or it wasn't the referee, it was the commentator, said he's starting to mouth breathe and, you know, he's gassing out. On the 9th or 10th round, I can't remember which one, his legs went jelly. Now, his legs went jelly due to two things. One, it could have been flooding with hydrogen ion. You can change that. And the number two reason is it could have been diaphragmatic fatigue. That blood was diverted. Blood was stolen from the legs to feed the diaphragm. That's why his legs went jelly.
Mm. So if the mask does train the breathing muscles, like the diaphragm, how often,
yes,
like, is it, people wear that shit for every workout, but is it a muscle that needs to get trained daily, or is it something that only needs to get trained once a week, or what have you found?
Typically, we would be training it daily. Breath holding, in the studies, it seems to show that two sets a week of 15 to 20 minutes actually produce very good results. Now, when I'm working with athletes, I actually have them train daily. But what I want to do is I look at their normal training routine and I want to superimpose what they're already doing, superimpose what I'm doing on top of their training. So they don't have to add or add any new exercises. All they're doing is tweaking some of their exercises. I think it's really the concept that we need to get across to them. So if you had somebody, say, using a training mask, half an hour a day would get you a good adaptation. But if you're already going to be training anyway, you know, why not just put it on for part of it? It's something like we would do with athletes as well. If I have an elite athlete coming in, I don't want them just nasal breathing 100% of the time. What I will do is I'll have them nasal breathe for about 50% of the time to add that extra load to their breathing muscles to get the adaptations, to create an intense feeling of breathlessness. But I'll have them mouth breathe for 50% of the time so that they can work out at maximum intensity.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so we want to prevent muscle decondition. So we do a combination of the two. And another point I'll say, like when I can think of it, we can stimulate anaerobic glycolysis by simply walking around. Now, if you think of some MMA fighters, they will train so hard that when it comes to competition, they haven't recovered sufficiently and are prone to injury.
Mm.
So if you're continuously training hard, you could be more prone to injury because it's trauma. And the reason to train hard, one of the reasons would be in stimulating anaerobic glycolysis. Well, you can do that by simply doing breath holds. And I would say to any of the people listening here, just try it themselves. Now, by the way, don't try a strong breath hold if the female is pregnant, if you've got high blood pressure. And the other thing I'd say is don't do it when you're lifting really strong weights, because it will shoot up your blood pressure. We've seen some guys, their blood pressure went up to 230 over 110.
Holy shit.
As a result of doing, say, 12 repetitions with breath holding. So one exercise you could do is simple a normal breath in through your nose, a normal breath out through your nose, pinch your nose, hold your nose, and start walking. And then as the air hunger gets a little bit stronger, jog. And as the air hunger gets stronger, fast jog. And go into a run. And keep going until you feel that the air hunger, you know, you've reached your limit. But then let go, but minimal breathe for 6 breaths. So take hardly any air in and out of your nose for 6 breaths. And if you were measuring a pulse ox, if you were using pulse oximetry, within about 4 days of practice, you will be able to simulate altitude training.
Wow.
And you'll be able to simulate it to a height of maybe 5,000 meters. And you can get your body to make those adaptations and you will feel it. You know, you'll feel it.
Mm. Yeah, that's
interesting. You'll also feel your nose opening up, etc. You'll feel your nose opening up. The lungs will open up. Your hands will go cold because blood is going to be diverted to the brain. You'll feel your breathing muscles contracting and your legs will go jelly because you're putting yourself into an anaerobic state.
Mm.
And is that a good like preparation for training, or is it more something that really depletes you so you would do it at the end or by itself?
We do a preparation for training. We have to be careful that if you do too many breath holds, it might make you too acidic.
Mm.
And as a result, then your ventilation is going to be higher than during the event. So say for a pre-match competition, say pre-competition event, if I'm working with people, I want them to be really focused, to have the mind very sharp. So for 20 minutes, we will do relaxation, focusing on the breath and helping to reduce anxiety of the mind and bringing the mind into the present moment. Now the athlete is too relaxed. So now I do have them do 6 strong breath holding to, again, focus the mind, but to activate the sympathetic response. But now they're too acidic. So now I get them to do 5 big breaths. And I get them to do 5 big breaths to offload CO2 and then to go straight into it. And the reason I have them do 6 breath holds before an event, you have a spleen and your spleen contains about 8% of your red blood cell count. If you do strong breath holding, your spleen will contract and release red blood cells into circulation. So you can improve the oxygen carrying capacity right before the event by doing, it takes 5 breath holds to activate the spleen.
Mm.
That's crazy.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, we've done the like basically the walking with holding your breath. We've done
Farmer's carries.
Yeah.
Holding your breath.
It's like it was like a short bike sprint through the nose, like maybe 20 seconds and then into, I think it was 3 deep breaths through the nose only and then a full exhale and then walking to fatigue, holding farmer's carries. And that's interesting you say that. A lot of the clients were taking themselves to like, you know, almost collapsing. Is that something you tell people to stay away from, or is that actually a good stimulus?
You don't need to
go that far.
You don't need to, but you'd have a higher risk of collapse if you do some hyperventilation beforehand.
Okay.
Because say for instance, if you were taking 30 big breaths, you're going to offload a lot of carbon dioxide.
Mm.
You will deplete CO2 in the lungs. You'll greatly reduce it in the blood, but carbon dioxide is the drive to breathe. So it's the neural drive to breathe. So if you get rid of carbon dioxide, the brain doesn't feel the need to breathe. So you'll hold your breath for so much longer. And because you can hold your breath for so much longer, your oxygen levels will go so much further down, will drop so much further.
Mm, mm.
And that's where you could have a collapse. So it's very, very unlikely that you would have a collapse if you don't do hyperventilation beforehand.
Okay.
So the hyperventilation, we do it, but the other thing I would say is that I think it really only suits people with good resilience. If I had somebody with a Bolt score of less than 25 seconds, I would say, don't do the hyperventilation. Don't do extreme hyperventilation because you don't have the resilience to cope with the changes of the blood gases.
Mm.
I'd sooner kind of build somebody up and have the exercises tailored to them at their level, as opposed to have them do the extremes just for the sake of it, you know?
Mm. So now I want to ask a follow-up question of this stuff. Some of it comes from the Wim Hof method.
Yes.
From what you understand about it, I'm sure you've researched a lot, obviously. What are some things maybe that are in there that people haven't considered that may not be as legit as what they think? Or maybe you can tell us why some things are working. I'm just not really sure where it all kind of sits with that, because he's a kind of a woo-woo guy, but he's also claiming some pretty intense stuff, and you know, people say it works. So, curious to what you think.
Yes. the whole part about hyperventilating to flood your body with oxygen is not correct. When you hyperventilate, when you take the 30 big breaths, it's not going to change your SpO2. If it does, it will increase it by maybe 1%. It will be insignificant and it will tend to hover. And again, you can practice that. Get a pulse oximeter, wear it, and do 30 hard breaths and see has it changed. And it won't change. It will increase the amount of O2 dissolved in the plasma, but the amount of oxygen dissolved directly in the blood is only about 2%. So it will increase that a little bit. It will get rid of a lot of carbon dioxide. For example, normal blood pH, usually about 7.365. With the Wim Hof method on the third cycle, it increased it to 7.75. That's throwing it off the charts. So the loss of carbon dioxide will allow you to hold your breath for longer.
Mm.
So I think it's a very interesting technique. I think it's brilliant in what he's done. He's put an awareness out there of breathing. I certainly wouldn't advise doing anything like that underwater. If you deplete your alarm to breathe, you don't feel a sensation to resume breathing. You could have a underwater blackout and people have drowned, unfortunately, as a result of it. I think really the key aspect of the technique is it's a stressor to the human body. It's like hormesis. You're stressing the body for the body to make adaptations. Now, the key question that I would have here is, how much do you need to get a hypoxic effect to get the body to make that stress? How extreme do you need to go? We've been teaching breath holding. I've been teaching to five-year-old children since 2002. And we don't see, you know, we keep everything within the limits and we can get these young kids to make the adaptations. That's something that needs to be studied. And his paper, the paper by Cox, was very interesting, looking at the Wim Hof technique, that they injected endotoxins into the individuals who were doing the Wim Hof technique and they were better able to resist the flu symptoms. And this is really something in terms of, you know, and being able to antagonize and influence the immune system by doing breath holding. It certainly needs more research, but I think it's a great way to go. Yeah, so there's some stuff that's brilliant in it. I think originally the explanation of flooding your blood or flooding your body with oxygen, that oxygen is roaming freely, it wouldn't stand up. But yeah, the essence of the method is good.
Mm. Okay. Yeah, cool. It is
interesting, that stuff. I mean, the thing that people have told me the most from using it is that they get sick less often. So that's kind of the path that I'm sort of exploring, is to like, I wonder what's going on there.
He says that it like activates your immune system, right? And then you can actually like get over a cold with the breathing techniques.
Mm.
Yes, well, that would have been something that we would like. A lot of my work was with asthma. And with people with asthma, they can be very prone to respiratory infections. We've seen that for 20 years. But again, I don't believe that you have to bring your breathing to the extreme to get that adaptation. Even the simple exercise, I'll talk about nitric oxide that's produced inside in your nasal cavity and in the paranasal sinuses. And every breath that you take into your lungs, you carry nitric oxide into your lungs if you breathe through your nose. Nitric oxide is a natural antibacterial. It sterilizes the air. It's a bronchodilator, but it also redistributes the blood throughout the lungs. And this will reduce chest infection. So even nasal breathing and adopting nasal breathing can be effective with this. Now, breath holding, something that we're doing as well. We've seen chest infections reduce. And I would say if you've got a head cold, try doing those breath holds that we spoke about earlier. But start off with a couple of easy ones and then just gently progress into them. You will find it will open up your nose, even when you've got a head cold. For people with rhinitis, we had a small pilot study at a hospital here in Ireland. And rhinitis is basically allergic hay fever. You know, allergic rhinitis will be hay fever.
Right.
It affects about 30% of the Western population. And if you have allergic rhinitis, hay fever, your sleep is more likely to be impacted. At 12-week follow-up, symptoms reduced by 70%. So here's the application of this in terms of the airways, you know, and as I said, like 20 clinical trials looking at this with asthma, and the clinical trials have been positive. One person asked me one day, well, where's the negative trials? We don't have any, and it's not that we hid them, you know, it's just I haven't come across them. They might be out there, but I haven't come across them.
And that's from doing the breath holding.
Breath holding and nasal breathing.
Yeah.
So it's a combination. Like when I'm looking at what I do, there's two pillars to it. You've got functional breathing training, and that's adapting breathing through the nose, activating the diaphragm, and getting your Bolt score up. And this is about addressing. So if you've got good functional breathing, you in turn will have good functional movement. And the International Journal of Sports Physical Therapy, they did a study that was published in October of 2017. They assessed breath hold time, and they found that people, they compared it with the functional movement screen. People with good breathing had good functional movement. And apparently the functional movement screen is validated to help predict the risk of injury in athletes. I don't know enough about the screen. I've heard mixed reports about it. Some people say it's very good, some people not so I'm not entirely sure. But I think it's interesting that we can tie in functional breathing with functional movement. And then the second pillar of it is simulation of altitude training, doing breath holding to disturb the blood acid base balance.
Yeah, that's a interesting part. Coming back to the outside of the performance realm and sort of the everyday life sort of part of it, I think obviously stress is a big part of people that live in like really urbanized environments, major cities, and you can tell. We do a lot of breath work with our clients when they come in. They're all very stressed, very highly strung, and they get some very like acute and potent changes to how they feel after they do some breath work with our coaches in some of the sessions. So one of the things I was sort of curious about is what I'll notice is if I'm like with a client or if I'm with someone else and I know they're kind of they're not necessarily a really stressed out person, and I'm tall, so I'm like 6'3", and I know that tall people will have bigger lungs, and I notice my breath rate's always way lower, obviously because we're slowing things down and we're right next to each other and we're taking breaths. Almost all the time when I'm breathing with someone, I'm like, they're doing 2 to 3 breaths, sometimes 4 for the time that I'm doing 1. And I'm not sure, is that because I'm taller, so my draw is longer, or is it that a fault of their breathing pattern?
It could be a combination of both.
Okay.
Number one, a person who comes in that's typically stressed will breathe harder. They'll breathe faster. A person who's prone to anxiety or panic attack, they'll often breathe more shallow and they'll breathe faster. So when we're looking at the breath, we're looking at a combination of the respiratory rate, which is the number of breaths per minute, if it was measured over a minute, versus the tidal volume, which is the size of each breath. And that will give us minute ventilation. So your respiratory rate is relatively slow. It's relatively low. We'll say 10 breaths per minute. The optimum, I'm only putting it out there, 10 breaths.
Sure,
it could be 6, it could be 8.
The
optimum number of breaths per minute would be 6. And that's when your Bolt score is heading for 40 seconds plus. So if you, say, have a respiratory rate of 10 breaths, and each size of your breath, you're a big guy, so the lung volume is larger. So you could be taking, say, 600-700 mil. Well, that would give you a minute ventilation then of about 6 to 7 liters per minute. Now, conversely, you could have somebody coming in with anxiety, and they could be taking 20 breaths per minute, and they're breathing fast. Now, the size of each breath will be smaller, but generally, I would expect it with somebody with anxiety and with panic. They have generally a very low Bolt score, and fast breathing is not good for the mind. Two ways that naturally, if you breathe slowly, you'll naturally have a calmer mind. If you Google this, Stanford slow breathing. So in March of 2017, researchers at Stanford Medical School, they identified a new structure in the brain in the locus coeruleus. And they said that this structure is spying on your breathing. So this structure in the brain is spying on the breath. And if you breathe fast, this structure will relay signals of agitation to the rest of the brain. And conversely, if you slow down your breathing, this structure within the brain will relay signals of calm to the rest of the brain. Now, nose breathing typically will slow down the breath, but nose breathing will also activate the diaphragm. And your diaphragm muscle is essential also for a calm mind. So if anybody comes into you with anxiety, what I would have them do is, the best way sometimes to activate the diaphragm is actually to lie on your back with your knees bent. We want diaphragmatic breathing, but we want light breathing. But even if they were just to try the sitting up, one hand on their chest, one hand just above their navel, really pay attention to the breath and start slowing down the speed of the air as it comes in and out of the nose. So as you're paying attention to your breathing, you'll feel the slightly colder air coming into your nose and feel the slightly warmer air as it leaves your nose. And as you feel your breathing, now start to slow down the speed of the breath as it comes in and out of your nose. So you're really slowing down the speed of the breath as it comes into your nose. Almost your breathing is so smooth that the fine hairs within the nostrils do not move. At the top of the breath, bring a total feeling of relaxation to the body and have a really slow and gentle, relaxed breath out. So you're slowing down the speed of the breath as it comes into the nose. And at the top of the breath, you're bringing a total feeling of relaxation to the body so that you have a relaxed, gentle breath out. And the whole purpose is that your breathing volume now is less than what it was before you started. You should feel a hunger for air. Now, that hunger for air is just telling you that carbon dioxide is increasing in the blood. And as we spoke about, carbon dioxide is the catalyst for hemoglobin to release oxygen to the cells. So ironically, when you slow down the breath and you have a hunger for air, more oxygen is getting released from the red blood cells to the cells. But another thing is, as you do that exercise, try and maintain the air hunger for 3 to 4 minutes. Now, if you get stressed, just take a little rest and you come back to it. But ultimately, keep it very simple. You're focusing on the airflow coming into your nose. You're focusing on the airflow leaving your nose. You're just gently softening your breathing. That's all. Just gently softening the breath. You want to feel air hunger. And as you do it, check the temperature of your body and also check the saliva in the mouth. And in general, people will find that their hands get warmer and there's an increased watery saliva in the mouth. Warmer hands, you've got improved blood circulation, not just because you've had your hands against your chest and tummy. You'll actually feel warmer. So we have 100,000 miles of blood vessels throughout the body, and we can influence that not by taking the hard, big breaths. If you know most people, if you say to them, how does your head feel if you take 10 big breaths in and out of your mouth? Well, they say, I can feel lightheaded. That's not a sign that there's more oxygen getting to the brain. It's the hard breathing is causing blood vessels to constrict. And with impaired blood flow, it's going to lead to reduced oxygen delivery. So we can influence the blood circulation and also the stress response. If you feel increased watery saliva in the mouth, that's a good sign.
Yeah, I did it in the car on the way here as I was listening to some of your stuff. Yes. I got that was definitely the thing I noticed. You know, much more saliva in my mouth.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
In a group of people, you loved it. And I know when I did the TED Talk, that was an audience participation. Now, it was real Irish style. They held the talk in a pub, and people were so I had them reduce their breathing, and then I was trying to get feedback. And, you know, it was normal, even with a group of people. You'll generally get 80% of people will feel warmer. They'll feel a change in body temperature. 10-20% will take a little bit more practice. And the other thing is that sometimes people get a little bit stressed with the air hunger. You have to go easy enough for it.
Okay. So that is the generally the protocol you give to reduce stress.
Yeah.
And lower stress.
Yeah, I think
so counterintuitive.
I suppose really what we want to do is we want to change everyday breathing patterns. When somebody has a higher Bolt score, their breathing is naturally slower. And if your everyday breathing is slower, your mind will tend to be calmer.
So just to be clear on the Bolt score, it's that first desire to really take a breath. Definitely. It's not the big stretch of like you maxing out. It's just that. Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. And you're just at rest.
It's the first definite desire to breathe.
You're just sitting.
You could say that you're stopping breathing until you feel the first distinct reaction of your brain telling you to breathe.
Okay.
That your body says breathe. Yeah. And your breath at the end should be fairly calm.
Okay. And you're just sitting there. You're just like, you're not standing, not lying. Okay. Just sitting. Okay.
So all of us sit there and relax into your body. If you relax into your body, you'll get a more accurate result, as opposed to if you're getting stressed, you'll have a less reduced breath the whole time.
Mm. What is the best Bolt score that you've seen, like that you feel like is a legit Bolt score?
Yeah, so I've seen 50s, I've seen 160.
160 seconds?
One Bolt score of 60.
Oh, okay.
In terms of when I'm working with people, a lot of the people coming in were coming in with complaints. So they had asthma, they had sleep apnea, anxiety, panic attacks. Typically, we'd see Bolt scores of 10 seconds.
Mm.
That was very normal. And that was for about 7,000 or 8,000 people. Now, we always generally see the higher Bolt scores amongst the athletes. But we do see exceptions to the rule. And I have seen Olympians with very low Bolt scores. So we have to bear in mind that physical training doesn't necessarily train your breathing. But if you train your breathing, it can change your physical training.
Mm.
And there's also a genetic influence on that as well. So some people basically what the Bolt score is measuring is your ventilatory response to CO2. And it is influenced in part by genetics, but you can influence it by training it. You can change it.
Mm.
And it's your ventilatory response to CO2 which will help to determine your degree of breathlessness during physical exercise. Because if you think of it this way, when you start doing physical exercise, your muscles produce more CO2. As the increased CO2 goes into the blood, the respiratory center in the brain will make you breathe harder because your body is breathing to get rid of excess CO2. If you've got a very strong reaction to the buildup of carbon dioxide in the blood, it means your breathing is going to be excessive. Whereas if you change it, that your brain is able to cope, or if the sensitivity, if the response of the brain to the buildup of CO2 is reduced, it means that when you're doing physical exercise, your breathing isn't going to be as hard because your body is able to cope with the buildup of CO2.
Mm.
And that would be it in a nutshell.
Mm. Yeah. What's interesting is, and I think I've kind of made my conclusion on it, but I'm curious as to where you stand on this, but a lot of different breath sort of experts in sort of the CrossFit world, the sport of fitness, I don't know how much you know about it, the ones that I trust have said that you want to leave breathing alone during training, like hard training. You're in a workout, it's a 10 minute workout, you just go into maximum, let your body do what your body does. And what I'm not so convinced on is some people are like, no, you want to control your breathing at those really, really high end sort of thresholds, as like respiratory thresholds and pain thresholds, to kind of calm yourself down and calm your breathing down. How do you sort of feel about that and sort of the high end threshold?
I'm not sure if you were really doing a high intensity, high end, if you can influence all that much control over your breathing.
Mm.
Your drive to breathe is going to be pretty strong, and you don't want to be tensing up the body or restricting. You don't want to be tensing up to try and restrict, to interfere with it too much. We don't want to deliberately interfere with the breathing muscles. When we're doing the breathe light exercise, we want to use the mind and even just focus on the airflow coming in into the nose. But we don't want to interfere with the muscles themselves to change breathing patterns.
Mm.
Now, it is during a sprint, we could do breath holding. But we wouldn't necessarily influence the breathing during the sprint. What I'm more concerned with is I want to influence the person's everyday breathing patterns and improve their functional breathing. So when they do physical exercise, that should carry into their physical exercise.
Mm.
So yeah, the only thing I would say is that if you did want to influence your breathing patterns during physical exercise, try doing your physical exercise, but have it in your mind of bringing a relaxation to your breathing, because you'll find that you'll be able to let your breathing settle. And you'll find also that you won't need to take in as much air as what you would ordinarily do. But don't tense up the body or restrict the breathing in any way. Just kind of bring a settling to your breath to allow the breath to find itself.
Mm. And is there anything to be said about athletes that constantly like fold over during like recovery portions of workouts? You know, they're doing their movements, whatever it is, sprinting, throwing, jogging, pull-ups, whatever it might be. But then, you know, it's like, all right, rest, 1 minute rest. You know, there's athletes that are able to kind of like walk around and or your hands on the head sort of thing. And then other people just instantly fold and they basically don't come out of the folded position until the next interval. What do you think about that?
Well, thank you for success of breathlessness. You know, really, what are we trying to do? We're trying to help you perform more with the same amount of effort.
Mm.
So if you've got two athletes and they're doing the same exercise routine and one athlete is bent over trying to catch their breath, whereas the other can continue, well, obviously the one that's trying to catch their breath, they've got disproportionate breathlessness. Now, it could be due to decondition. They could be in poor condition physically, but also it may be due to a breathing pattern. If you look at a football team, generally, if you've got a football team, all of the players will have a typically constant and similar training regime. But yet you will have one or two players who can be prone to breathing pattern disorders.
Mm.
And, you know, statistically in the Western world, it's 10% of the population. And that's going to carry into sports.
Mm.
So we would say 9.5% of athletes will have definite breathing pattern disorders, regardless of the caliber they're at.
Mm.
But you may have, you know, with asthma, it's as high as 30%. With people with anxiety, it's high as well. Could be 50%. So in certain subsets of the population, if you have an athlete who's prone to anxiety, I'd be looking at their breathing. If you have an athlete who's getting bronchoconstriction, they may have asthma, they could be getting exercise-induced asthma or just bronchoconstriction, they need to look at their breathing. Or an athlete who's gassing out too soon, look at their breathing. I'd sit them down, measure their Bolt score, and I think bring it into your gym. You know, if you're seeing somebody, when their breathing is recovered, just say, I just want to check something. I want to see what your Bolt score is, and it'll give them feedback.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, a lot of our athletes are very conditioned, but then I was just thinking that, like you said, there's about 10% of them. No matter how much training they do, no matter how fit they get, they're always folding over to get Aaron during the session. It's sort of an interesting paradigm there. I wanted to come back just quickly. Raph mentioned it earlier, but we didn't really capitalize on it. Snoring. It's sort of a big issue for a lot of people. You sort of explained to us how you've helped people or what methods you've helped people that may suffer from snoring and some of the issues that maybe they didn't think about that comes from snoring?
Sure. We need to look at two things with snoring. Snoring can happen through the mouth, whereby the individual is breathing air in through their mouth and it goes and basically there's vibrations of the soft tissue at the back of the mouth. So your soft palate, for example, if you put your tongue up into your roof of your mouth, and if you were to drag your tongue along the roof of the mouth until you feel the soft tissue at the back of the palate, mouth snoring is caused by the vibration of the soft tissue at the back.
Mm.
To stop mouth snoring, you simply tape your mouth with very light micropore tape or lip seal tape. It's a practice that we've been doing for many years. So that will stop mouth snoring straight away. Now, nasal snoring is when there's turbulence inside in the nose and also when the nose meets the back of the airway. We want to get the nose open. And the nose and blocking exercise, you could simply even do this. Normal breath into your nose, normal breath out your nose, pinch your nose, hold your nose, and gently nod your head, holding your head, holding your breath, nodding your head up and down, and doing it until you feel a medium to strong air hunger. Do that 4 or 5 times, your nose will open. Then the more you breathe through your nose, the better your nose will work for you. So the thing with snoring is the exchange of a large volume of air through a narrowed space. People are breathing too hard. So we want to get their breathing through the nose, but we want to get it lighter. So we practice a combination of exercises to help open up the nose, but also the breathe light exercise to bring down their breathing volume towards normal. When your breathing is lighter during sleep, you're less likely to snore.
Mm.
Yeah. That was good. Yeah.
What if you put the tape on and, like, you really need to, like, will you just rip the tape off, like, during your sleep? I assume no.
Most people won't. If you feel, say, for instance, if somebody has compromised nasal passages, I have, as a result of deviated septum, one nostril is smaller than the other. So if you have somebody with chronic rhinitis, now bear in mind, we can show people how to decongest the nose anyway by simply holding the breath. And the more they breathe through their nose during rest, the more it works for them. If their nose is compromised, there is a product actually. I was showing it to somebody else earlier on. This isn't the right one, but this one here is an Australian product.
Turbine.
And this is used for athletes. So if we have an athlete that comes in with a compromised nose, and if I want them to breathe through the nose, I'll have them wear the turbine. And basically, a turbine is a small little device that goes into the nose. Mm. And if you do this for me, put one finger on either side of your nose and arch.
Mm.
So it just opens up your nose.
It's pulling.
You'll feel it opens up your nose.
Stretching the skin on your nose, basically.
They're called nasal dilators. So if you have somebody who, when they first tape up and they're feeling very panicked, we would suggest using nasal dilator for the first couple of weeks, just to help overcome that feeling of panic. But the more you breathe through your nose, again, the more it's going to work for you.
Is it the is it like the strip, the nasal strip, or is that just gimmicky?
It's the same as the Breathe Right strip. The benefit of the plastic devices is that you can use them, reuse them, but also we use the plastic devices during sports because the strip, if you sweat a lot, the strip can come off. Whereas the plastic device, even if you're sweating during physical exercise, it's not going to impact it.
So the strip still gives you what you're after with that plastic device? It's
yes,
still
it's
okay.
The same.
So it
the
still
strip
works.
Is the same.
Yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
It is. It's a nasal, any nasal dilator to help open up the nasal passages will also work.
Mm. And you know one thing, Pat, I feel like you're qualified to answer this. I've never really gotten a solid answer, but what is going on when people are yawning? Obviously, when you're yawning, you're tired. But is it because you've slowed your breath so far down that your body is now trying to get more oxygen to wake you up? We don't know.
Yeah, don't know. And yawning is something that you'll see very much in people with chronic hyperventilation. People with poor breathing will tend to yawn more.
Mm.
So there's something else going on. I think it's just more complex than what we think. You know, it's so funny because even the fact that we're talking about it, you'll actually feel the
yeah.
yawn.
Yeah,
and I'd say your listeners
so
listening to it now will probably yawn.
Someone just yawned.
It's just one of those things. So we don't know. I haven't came across what somebody to give me the real explanation of what's happening there. I don't know.
Mm.
I feel like it's just complicated and too boring for someone to actually dedicate their life to studying. Yawning.
Anyone that's gone down that path has fallen asleep too many times. Like, that the research can't
I
be done.
I can't be fucked.
That's funny. Cool. That's most of the questions I had. Did you want to ask Pat anything else before we jump to the final questions?
No, I think that, and just on the finish off the yawning situation, sorry, not the yawning, the snoring situation at night.
It's a personal issue.
So is your recommendation just wear the tape over the mouth and it's just going to get better over time and do the head nodding and stuff to clear your airways before you go to sleep?
What I do is get your bowl score up above 25 seconds.
Okay.
Mm.
So practice to breathe light exercise during the day and practice it to change your breathing patterns and also to adopt diaphragmatic breathing. There's an extreme to snoring would be obstructive sleep apnea. And it's when there's collapse of the upper airways. So basically the throat collapses during sleep, but your diaphragm is linked to the upper airway dilator muscles. So if we want to try and get these upper airway muscles working more, we need to get diaphragmatic breathing going. So I'd say get your bowl score up to 25 seconds and tape your lips together.
Mm.
And when your bowl score is heading for 25, 30 seconds, you'll find a significant reduction in snoring. It may be that you have nasal issues. Now, you can help decongest your nose by doing the breath holding. So do a combination of breath holding to open up the nose. And it's always after an exhalation. And breathe light. But ultimately, it's about getting the bowl score up.
Mm. Well, that'd be great. Yeah, like when we travel, it's hard for me to sleep. So it'd be fantastic.
It's not too bad for me.
I actually did have one more question before we get into the final four questions. And it's sort of just around like when I'm doing these kind of breathing practices or whatever the recommendation is, like what generally is the protocol? Is it an everyday sort of thing? Like, for example, people say the only benefits towards meditating is if you do them every single day. This this sort of breath training stuff, is this a daily practice that you do and people need to do, or is it?
Yeah, it depends on people's motivation.
Okay.
If we had somebody coming in who was quite unwell, I need them to do 60 minutes of this per day.
Oh my God.
Now, if I'm working with an athlete, I want to get the athlete up to 40 seconds of a Bolt score. So certainly for a few weeks, I need them to really be putting it into practice. I want them to do 20 minutes of breathe light before sleep. And I also want them to do a practice of, say, 10, 15 minutes during the day. But adopt some of their training program to breathing through the nose and bring in some breath holding. So, for example, if you've got some guy that's warming up, why not do the warm-up with the mouth closed?
Mm.
There already you're going to add an extra load.
Mm.
If you're doing high knees, why not do some of the high knees breath holding and get in 6 to 10 breath holds during the warm-up with nasal breathing? Like, there's already 10, 15, 20 minutes that you're brought the breathing exercise into your way of life.
Mm.
So if you were to aim for cumulatively 30 minutes to an hour per day, but not necessarily by having to put the time aside, because the reality is people are not going to do it.
Mm.
Incorporate it and tweak your existing routine and bring it into it.
Mm.
When you're in your gym, you would see people even do the lightest exercise and they'll do it with their mouth open.
Mm.
And there is no need. You can achieve an 85 to 90% work rate with your mouth closed.
Mm. Mm.
And it's a far better quality because there's a really brilliant ENT, ear, nose and throat surgeon from New Zealand. His name is Dr. James Barclay. And he's been writing about the importance of breathing through the nose for at least since early 2000s anyways, when I came across his work. But he spoke about Swift in 1988, these were patients who were post-jaw surgery, who were forced to breathe through their noses, that the oxygen uptake in the blood increased versus mouth breathing. So you can imagine then an athlete who is breathing using their nose, they're breathing using their diaphragm, they're taking air deeper into the lungs, but nitric oxide is redistributing blood throughout the lungs. There's a better gas exchange happening, and there's going to be better oxygen delivery to the cells.
Mm.
So here you have an athlete, nasal breathing. Yes, it's a bit tougher, but your muscles and cells are going to get more oxygen.
Mm, interesting. Mm. What do you think about the like a pillow when you sleep? Obviously, because that can change the position of your head and it can manipulate your airways. Yes. Do you have like a general protocol that you recommend?
We don't give it too much, but you're correct. Head tilt during sleep. I think the worst position during sleep is sleeping on your back, because if you sleep on your back, your tongue is more likely to fall into the airway.
Mm.
But the pillow, you want to have everything in a line. So if you can have your upper airway in a complete line, you don't want your head tilted back. You don't want your head tilted forward. You don't want it to one side. So if you weren't able to have a pillow that you could keep your head in line with your spine, it would be a better way in terms of you'd be helping to avoid head tilt, but we don't look into it too much.
Mm. Yeah, it's a tricky one. Doesn't really seem like there's a solid answer for it, but I can imagine.
Well, dentists will know, though. People who are doing cone beams and people who are doing scans of the airways, they will know that the airway is smaller when the head is tilted.
Mm.
And if you've got a smaller airway, you increase the negative pressure during sleep, and that could lead to sleep problems. So I think it could be worth exploring for some people anyway.
Mm. Interesting. That's good. So, Pat, we've got four final questions to wrap up with.
Sure.
So, first question is, if you had an opportunity to sit down and interview anyone that is alive today, who would you interview and why?
One person I would talk to would be Eckhart Tolle.
Yeah.
And Eckhart Tolle would be well-known spiritual. He's an author. He wrote the first book, was The Power of Now. I'm very intrigued to the degree to which he has achieved stillness of the mind on a permanent basis. I am also very intrigued to see if anger and if the normal human emotions that come in to the human, does it affect him? That would be one question that I would ask him. And it doesn't necessarily come true in his books. Now, his stuff is absolutely brilliant. I'm a big fan of his. It was one of my first introductions into quietness of the mind and the power of that. But again, you have the human element that the mind has always got a tendency to want to take control. And it's our kind of aim then to be able to tame that. But he has tamed it without any conscious effort. Whereas the rest of us mere mortals, we have to be watching it.
That is very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you read that book, Power of Now?
Yeah, very long time ago though.
Yes. Yeah. It's an amazing, amazing book. And I think it's tremendous because I think there's a void now. And also with the revolution of the internet, if you Google Microsoft Goldfish Study, in 2002, Microsoft, they researched 3,000 Canadians and they found that the average attention span was 12 seconds back in 2002. And in 2012, they did the same research and the attention span has dropped to 8 seconds.
Mm.
And they said this is a problem because as a goldfish has an attention span of 9 seconds. Now, if our attention span is dropping, it means that our mind is becoming more active and more incessant. And I think we have a problem with mental health down the road. Now, we probably have it already, but I think it's going to get worse. And I think it's going to get worse with the generation who can't leave their mobile phones alone, who are constantly looking at it, distracted. So all of the internet information, you know, all of the revolution in modern technology, it has completely changed our lives. But we also have to bear in mind, is it training the brain to be distracted? Because ultimately, when we want to achieve anything worthwhile in life, we need to have focus, we need to have concentration, and we need to be able to apply 100% of our attention to doing something. And it all comes in, it all ties in with the breath.
No, I absolutely think it you're right. And I do little self-experiments every now and then when I manage to get away and you know, on a holiday or whatever, I ban myself from my phone and I watch my attention span and my patience change dramatically in that time. And then when I feel it come back, that patterning, that desire to look at your phone, that dopamine release that you get over and over and over again throughout the day, destroys your memory. Absolutely destroys your memory. I've actually had it to points where, like, because we've been podcasting for 4 years, over that time my phone use has increased dramatically just with everyone else's in society, and I've found it harder to hold on to ideas that I'll have to ask a guest in the podcast, because I'm so distracted. I'll bounce between ideas and then it comes to the next question and I'm like, shit, I can't remember anything. Like, I feel like a goldfish.
It doesn't matter though, because your listeners have also got the same problem, so they can't remember either. So I feel like everyone just moves on the same wavelength and no one really notices the difference.
Everyone's lost. But you can have a significant advantage over a lot of people if you don't use your phone that much. Like, you can get a lot more done, I feel. You can achieve a lot more. So it is an ongoing battle. I feel like outsourcing as much of the phone use as possible is ideal. Like, if I didn't run businesses, I probably wouldn't have social media. Purely because, that is the reason we use it primarily, but you get sucked into all the other stuff, you know, the scrolling and the messaging and all that unnecessary stuff. But, we'll keep working on it. So,
you have to do it.
That's right. Pat, second question is, what is something that you do every single day? I feel like I know what this answer might involve that you feel like is...
Yeah, I suppose I'd be making it too obvious. One thing that I like to do is, I want to get in physical exercise every day. I'm not an athlete. My physical exercise is going to be very, very, you know, easy. But that's what I do. That's one thing. And the other thing is to spend some time getting out of my mind. In other words, taking my attention out of the mind, putting it on the breath, and making a habit of bringing my attention onto my breathing at regular times throughout the day. I think it's very good for my focus and it helps keep me grounded. You know, I think the mind is just one of those things that you have to work with it. And really, in terms of creativity and bringing creativity into the life, we need to have space in the mind for creative and fresh and new ideas to originate. And if the mind is too active, it's not going to happen.
Mm.
So, yeah, so I try and, you know, for the last 20 years, the breath has been a huge part of me. And it's something that I bring in unconsciously now. It just happens.
Mm. That's awesome. Yeah, the doing something every day that distracts you from, yeah, just what your constant low-level, you know, hum is, that low-level anxiety of whatever you're thinking about all day, to kind of turn that off is awesome. And I think everyone has a different practice they can probably think of that does that. For a lot of people, yeah, it's definitely some kind of physical exercise, which is, you know, and we've discussed this before, like, people get to a point, they can't take in any more information, they can't produce anything useful, they can't function in the workplace, and that's because there are actual limits to what your mind can do in terms of focus and concentration, and they tap out. You know, if you start at 8 or 9 a.m., they're going to tap out by, you know, 1, 2 p.m. in the day. Yeah. It's time to take a break. Yeah. It's time to do something physical, you know. Yeah. No, that's good. It's good to be reminded of that. So, third question, Pat, is there anything recently that you believed in that now you've changed your mind on?
Yeah, it's a difficult question. I was in the late 1990s, you know, I was in the corporate world for 3 years and I felt it was a total rat race. It was total competition. You have young employees who were pitted against each other. You're indoctrinated. And I always said to myself, I'm never going to want massive stress like that. And just by chance, anyway, I went into the breath and everything. But now, of course, it's turned into our own little company. So now we have a company. And in the last year or so, the last 3 years, like 1 year, I spent 165 days away from Ireland in terms of traveling abroad. And I was just thinking of it when that question came up today. And I was just thinking, I swore that I wanted a life with quality of life. And it's this balance. And I think it's I achieved it. And then the success has taken it over, that it's bringing me back into the corporate world.
Mm.
Granted, it's my work.
Mm.
And it's about achieving that balance. Mm. And that's just one thing that I'm working with now. And I think everybody needs to achieve it. So that's kind of that cycle that's happening now with me at the moment.
Mm.
And that's my next goal, is to bring it back to where it was back in the early 2000s.
So what were you doing in the early 2000s that you're not doing now?
I was working with the breath, but I wouldn't have been as busy in terms of it was manageable.
Mm.
Whereas now I'm booked out for 14 months.
Mm.
So now you're talking about the logistics, you're talking about everything else. Now, the one thing that I have is, you know, I work for myself, I can call my shots and I can put my own pressure. But at the same time, we too have deadlines.
Mm.
So I've got two books in the pipeline. I've got a third one that is nearly there. We've got a new product as well coming out. We released a product a few months ago. So yeah, so it's really breathing now is coming on the map, and I wanted to go with it, you know. I've been 20 years watching breathing happen, and I really feel that something has happened in the last 3 years, and I'm being carried on that tide. So I want that tide to carry me nicely, not to drown me.
Mm. I know what you're saying, but like, I think equally, you know, when you're doing great work like you are and you're helping so many people, it does ultimately require you to sacrifice some level of yourself to help so many people.
Yes.
It's just kind of the name of the game when you are so influential and you do have, you know, a desire and an ambition and something you know is good for people, you just have to put more out to get yourself out there. It just doesn't happen easily, right? Unfortunately.
But I believe the fun should always be in it.
Of course.
And, you know, that's what I always want to maintain. I want to maintain it that I'm lucky, you are lucky, we're lucky people that we have an occupation that we love to do. And not everybody has that.
Mm.
And I want to maintain the fun in that all the way throughout, because it's when it's enjoyable that we can bring our creativity to it, that we can stay on the forefront of it.
Mm.
But if it becomes too much of a burden, that the workload is too kind of stifling, that's going to impact that. And I think it's something that everybody will reach at some point. And that's my quest at the minute.
Mm.
I'd love to, that's awesome. Love to hear how you go on that quest. Final question, Pat. Maybe you can recommend for our listeners a book and maybe a quote if you have one as well.
Sure. I can't remember of any quotes offhand, but I've two books that I've read fairly recently. One that I kept on meaning to read, but I never got around to it. Tuesdays with Maury. I thought it was a super little book. Mm-hmm. It's a series of lectures of a young guy going to speak with his former lecturer who was dying. And the former lecturer gave him some tremendous tips on life.
Mm.
It's an amazing book. It's teaching us about what's really important. And a second book that I've read very recently is one called The Choice. And The Choice is by Edith Eger. So basically, she was in the Holocaust, and she's a psychologist. Now, she's still alive. She's in her 80s. But she was very honest about the trauma and about the complexities of the human mind. So those are two books that I would highly recommend.
Sorry, the second one was The Choice?
The Choice by Edith Eger, yeah. E-G-E-R.
Got it. Perfect. I'll definitely check those out.
And the first one is Tuesdays with Mario by Mitch Albom.
Awesome. Fantastic. Well, Pat, this has been a very enjoyable conversation with me. As you can imagine, over the 4 years, we've had some very similar conversations lots of times, and it's refreshing, firstly, to have an Irishman on the podcast, but secondly, to speak about some stuff that we haven't really spoken about before at that sort of depth. So it's been a really fun time.
Great. Yeah, I enjoyed it. Thanks very much, guys, and thanks very much for helping to get the information out there.
No, that's all right.
Hopefully we'll see you in Sydney when you come.
Yeah, I'll just...
Is it early next year you're coming?
Yeah, people can go on your website, oxygenadvantage.com. If they go to 3-day instructor certification training, there's like a list that would probably match up against the list of like, I don't know, the Beatles or Bon Jovi. But anyway, you're in San Francisco, London, Warsaw, which is Poland, Galway. What's Galway?
I hope you know. Ireland.
Ireland. I thought so. I was going to say Scotland, but Galway.
You might have heard of the song Galway Girl.
Yes. Oh, Galway Girl.
Yes,
okay.
By Ed Sheeran.
Yeah. That makes sense. Tampa?
Where's that?
It's in Finland. Oh, okay. Finland.
Interesting. Berlin.
Never heard of it.
London again. New York. And then Sydney in the 26th to the 28th of July, 2019. Copenhagen, then the Netherlands. We have everyone over the world probably got one, or you know, we've got people from all these different areas. So if this is something you're interested in, I would highly recommend doing it. And I'm probably going to follow up with some stuff there. But yeah, oxygenadvantage.com, and they can go everywhere from there. So Pat, once again, thanks so much for being on. We appreciate your time, and we'll follow up with you soon. Thank you, Project, for tuning in again to another episode of the My Muscle Project. We release an episode every single Monday. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, the My Muscle Project, to stay up to date with everything we're doing. And if you have some time, leave us a review and a 5-star rating on iTunes.
And don't forget, we have a second show of the week, The After Show. So it's no longer a rest day on Thursdays. If you have any questions for Lachlan and I for that show, head to themymuscleproject.com/The After Show. And if you ask a question, we'll answer it on the show.
Thanks again so much, Project, and we'll see you all next week.